Welcome to Building Better Businesses, an ABA podcast. Learn firsthand from business owners who built successful ABA businesses. Utilize proven techniques and strategies to help your practice thrive. This is Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast with Jonathan Mueller.
Rami Paulus is the founder and CEO of Midwestern Janitorial, providing janitorial services exclusively for the medical and ABA fields. Rami is also a former actor and heavy metal drummer. Rami, welcome to the pod.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.
I have to start with a heavy metal because this is something where we first met. We connected on.
The most important part.
I was a lead guitarist and bad singer in a heavy metal band in high school, Apocalypse. We broke up in 10th grade, and it was devastating to me because my axe was my life. But that's right, I played guitar for a long time afterwards. But it was like transformational because like guitar was how I interacted with my world, and because I was a big introvert as a kid.
Yeah.
And that was my outlet. Tell me about your like musical and heavy metal journey, man.
Teen angst, anger, a desire to really express feeling at all times. Mm. You put drumsticks in that kid's hands at 14, and you can beat on something for hours and create. That was really good for me. That was really good for me. And, 14-year-old boy, what do you want the most? You want to attract the attention of women the most, more than anything else. This is the most important thing. And it's probably the most important thing for a 40-year-old man too, by the way. It never ends being the most important thing.
Totally. So that's interesting. So you, because I reflect on my experience, I don't know that I even really played for crowds. In my mindset, I intentionally, we played a handful of gigs. Backyard parties, right? Yeah. Our crowning achievement was we played at a local, boys and girls club, like on a Saturday night. And, we got fourth, yay, out of four bands. So that was us. But were you acting? How much of it was like you wanted to pound the drums, get the teenage angst and like channel the music versus like, hey, I'm going to play this for the crowd and for my people out there. And
14 to like 16 or 17 is me in the basement banging on the drums. Now and then a friend from high school comes over to the basement with their guitar and we jam. But mostly it's really me playing while simultaneously daydreaming that I'm in Motley Crue.
Yes.
And I'm Tommy Lee and I'm playing and there's 20,000 people and, you know, women are salivating over me and, you know, young kids are banging their heads and getting their fix in. This is my dream. And then, maybe 17, I start to get some traction in putting real bands together. First, I'm invited to play in a band. The band falls apart very quickly, but it opens that door in my mind that now I can actually be in a band. This can be real. And so then I go about putting a band together and I get a band together and, I'm setting out to play music like, let's say Tool or Alice in Chains. Mm. Darker, harder, heavy, expressive, artistic hard rock. And that's a lot of fun. 18, 19, I get recruited into this glam metal band. That's a call back to 1983 Motley Crue. I'm wearing red lipstick. I'm wearing leather pants. I'm playing shirtless. And we're doing shows to like 200 people. And I think we're the Beatles. I'm arguing with my dad routinely. My dad is saying, Rami, you need to go to university. You need to get your education. I'm like, Dad, I play rock and roll. I have credibility. If I go to school, that's it. My life is over, man. Nobody will take me seriously. The people who I want to impress are losers, Dad. And we've really got to stick to the program here.
Oh my gosh, there's so much to unpack there, dude. I love Motley Crue is one of my top five favorite bands. Glam metal was like its own little thing. Yeah. I want to chat about your dad because your family had a family business many years, decades. And yet you were sort of only peripherally involved, or maybe not directly yes. involved in that yes. business. And tell me more about that business and sort sure. of what you saw from the outside. And yeah. and is that part of your inspiration for becoming an entrepreneur?
Yeah, great. Okay, so let's just start with who my parents are, because it's really important. My parents are Iraqi immigrants who left Iraq in the late 70s for Nigeria, Africa. Mm. And they go to Nigeria largely on a whim to follow my dad's brother, who went there first on a whim. That there was, so they need to escape what they're facing in Iraq. And for some reason, my dad's brother sees some business opportunity in Nigeria he can go capitalize on. Mm. My dad follows him. All the brothers end up following. And within a couple of years, they are importing and exporting heavy equipment from Iraq to Nigeria. Anything from a small bobcat to major dozers and cranes. Mm-hmm. And they are supplying the local Nigerian construction industry. And 15, 20 years into that, so let's say the early 90s, they start supplying pipeline contractors strictly. That becomes their niche, gas mm-hmm. pipeline contractors. 10, 15 years into that, so if my timeline is correct, let's say the late 90s or early 2000s, we end up partnering with one of those companies. Mm-hmm. And so for the last 20 plus years, that's the family business. We're pipeline contractors in Nigeria, Africa. Mm-hmm. So somewhere between the late 70s and the late 80s, my family has set up shop in Nigeria, and they've moved to London, England. Mm-hmm. And so my brothers and sisters, who are all, by the way, 19 years older than me plus, mm-hmm. 19 years between me and the next one, grow up between Iraq, Nigeria, and London. They moved to Detroit, and that's when I'm born in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And so my parents are conservative immigrants who have very traditional family values, and their values and principles are, to say the least, timeless and grounded in lots of generational tradition, custom, ritual, etc. Mm. So I'm growing up with this dad, and I'm this guy.
The lipstick-wearing heavy metal drummer.
Lipstick-wearing heavy metal drummer. And I would come home and I would say the most outrageous things to get under my parents' skin. I would announce, you know, a different sexuality. I would tell them, you know, I'm, you know, whatever crazy thing I could think of to really rock their boat. That's what I was doing as a teenager. Oh, by the way, let me backtrack. They sent me to military school for 2 years when I was 12. Mm. Okay. So I go to military school from 12. I come back at 14. Mm. And I'm now far more disciplined and conscientious than I ever was before. And I'm completely owning that as part of my identity. This is a very important part of me. Mm-hmm. It's a line in my life. But I'm still having a lot of fun picking on my parents. Because I think what good parents do is they make it safe enough that you can do that. Mm. You can rebel, because you'll have something safe to come back to when you come to your senses. Mm. I think that's part of what good parenting amounts to. Mm. So where was I? So yeah. So I'm going through many transformations from 1 year to the next, as you do. And I'm paying very little attention to anything to do with the family business or the family's values, let's say. Mm. And I'm doing my own thing. And 19, I end up meeting some guy who offers me a film part. Mm. And I'm still a drummer. I don't even know what acting is. I mean, I've seen films, but I've never thought about what is an actor. Never even heard of it. And he offers me a film part, and I go, you want to pay me money to just say these stupid lines in front of the camera? I was so arrogant and cocky. I thought, God, what a moron this guy is. But yeah, sure, I'll do it. I'll do you a favor. So he gives me the script and he goes, just do me a favor. We're going to shoot this in like 6 months. Don't go taking any acting classes. Don't do any of that. I'll direct you. We'll work this out between us. I said, okay, no problem. And then I start to practice the lines and I'm practicing them in the mirror and I'm realizing what a fool I sound like and look like. So I go and I take an acting class, even though this guy told me not to, because I thought, I can't, this guy has made a horrible mistake. I can't show up and just give him this. This is not what he meant, you know? And I go and I take an acting class and I fall completely in love with it. It blows my mind. It exposes me to the things about me that I've never articulated, but I've always felt, like the fact that I really love people. I really love people. I love to be close to people. I love to get to know people. I love to serve people. I don't know how else to say it. I just love people. And acting, if you're studying with the right professor, is a long-term study of people, people's motivations, people's interests. Like it's like the economics of people or something. And so I thought, this is something I really love. And I ventured to New York later that year, and I did a few shows off Broadway. And then after a year, New York was a little depressing because New York's a great city, but it's so big and it's so vast. And if you're you don't know anybody in this big city, and it can kind of overwhelm you. But okay, let me get out of here and I'm going to go to LA. And LA is a lot easier because LA is, how would you characterize it? There's more conformists in a place like LA than there is in New York. New York really celebrates the individual. LA really celebrates the group belonging. Something like that. So you can hide more easily in LA. And I studied my craft. And I pretended to put forth the effort of actually getting acting jobs, and I never did. I didn't put myself out there. I just wanted to study. I wanted to study, and I also didn't want the rejection the onslaught of rejection that one must take on if you're going to choose a field like this, to deter me or cancel me out of the game sooner than it needed to. I just wanted to be left alone to study for as long as possible. I could have ridden the fuels of my passion like this for the rest of my life. I could have said, I'll make $2,000 a month for the rest of my life working in whatever odd jobs I can work. And I'll get used to that. And this will be how it is for me, but I'll get to study. I'll get to be in the creative domain of my mind as much as possible. And then I met my now wife, and we started dating. Still, nothing had changed in my mind. I was still just a guy that wanted to be left alone to be creative. And then I proposed to her. And the second I proposed to her, I kid you not, I immediately became my square father. I suddenly saw life through his lenses. And I suddenly had an appreciation for all that he had provided me with in terms of a framework and a structure. And again, although I rebelled against it, I saw it because he provided it as a model. You can't rebel against something that isn't there. So I was seeing it. I just was rejecting it, but I was seeing it. So I was obviously taking it in. And so I proposed to my wife, and immediately that light bulb went off. And all of a sudden, my passion in life became providing for a family, leading a family, whatever that meant to me at that moment. And then going about doing whatever I needed to do so that I could make that a reality. And well, what do I need to do? Well, for one thing, I need to not be in a place like LA. It doesn't represent my values anymore. They're changing. Now I need to be back by the family that I wanted to leave at 20, the family that I wanted to reject, I now want to be a part of. Get back to the old community, the community that I wanted to leave at 20. Now I want to belong to that community. Working, I had no work ethic. I didn't want to work. part of the creative calling is that you can actually pretend that the reason you're not working is because you have a creative calling, when it's really just because you don't like to work.
Right. Yours is such an incredible story. And there's a couple things I'd like to drill in on, but I here's something that strikes me. The journey of an entrepreneur is a journey of rejection. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's outright rejection, like, you know, your company fails.
Yep.
Sometimes, but even if you have all successful companies, you're facing rejection from when you talk to people about this thing that doesn't exist, that you're crazy enough to say can't exist, this organization that you want to create to change the world, or you know, when you go to, like, you get bank rejections, right? Or you get you know, customer rejections, you name it. I mean, it's almost as an entrepreneur, you're bathed in rejection. Mm-hmm. And so, and you're clearly a very successful entrepreneur now, but as I was struck by this idea that you didn't want to face rejection in acting, what changed?
Well, I mean, first of all, there's no shortage of domains in life where rejection is inevitable. For example, even in a great marriage, a husband faces rejection from his wife from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Even in a very successful business, there's many customers who you would have wanted to be your customers who have said no to you.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up as a kid, any kid who's been blessed with at least a modicum of some bullying that can build some character has been rejected by his people he's wanted to be friends with. And I say blessed because, you know, it's a blessing, and I think it should be. It should be, there should be a place for it.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I think I faced a lot of rejection, but I would say the most rejection that I faced during my years as an actor was self-imposed rejection. It was a rejection of low self-esteem. So you think to yourself, okay, let me go attend this audition. Then you reject yourself and you say, nah. So there's rejection there too. I was just projecting that they were going to reject me, and so I just did the rejection for them. So it's not like my mind wasn't regularly facing rejection. So I think that the real transformation was the transformation of self-esteem.
Hmm.
And the transformation of self-esteem was directly linked to the introduction of purpose in my life. Purpose being, all of a sudden, I have the vision of a family, and I'd like to provide for that family. So now the excitement for me is that other people will hold me responsible for their well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, I had passions,
mm-hmm.
but I probably thought I had purpose, but I don't think I had purpose looking back. I just had passions, things that really turned me on. But I didn't have anywhere that I absolutely needed to be, or things fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're both fathers. There's places we must be daily. We can't mm-hmm. simply just decide to get so drunk that we can be hungover all day the next day in bed and everything will be fine. It won't be.
Mm. It won't.
So that's purpose, right? There's responsibilities. So I think that's what changed, is that all of a sudden I said, okay, now I'll take on as much rejection as the world wants to give me, because I have a purpose now. And I'll have to face that rejection as part of fulfilling this purpose.
Hmm.
And so, again, growing up, knowing of this family business didn't mean that I had any business sense, because I wasn't participating in it. It was geographically unfeasible. And but when that light bulb went off, part of becoming, like how I say, becoming my father, part of that was adopting a business sensibility,
mm-hmm.
where all of a sudden the few things that are truly very important take center stage in one's mind, and then they become the center of focus.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, very early in my business, that was focusing on becoming the kind of leader that was worth the best talent becoming attracted to, and then staying with.
You know, I love how you sort of put the onus on yourself as a leader, right? You have to be the best leader you can be to deserve that talent. Yeah. And Rami, this is almost like a therapy session for me. So, and I'm not sure I've ever shared this, and certainly not like live. So when I moved in eighth grade, I moved to a new high school. You know, my parents were in the Foreign Service, right? So we moved around as kids. Yeah. It was a high school. It was harder than any other schooling I went to. It was these wonderful people in community, but you know, it was sort of, there's a little bit of hoity-toityness there. And, and I was the heavy metal kid wearing black Iron Maiden t-shirts, grew a mullet on the school bus every day to from school, headphones in, stare straight ahead. I'm not going to engage with anyone. Yeah. I'm out against the world.
Yeah.
But you know what that really was? I actually craved deep down inside to be accepted, to belong at this new school, to find my new niche and community. Yes. But I was so afraid of not belonging that it was easier to be that kid wearing an Iron Maiden t-shirt, not talking to anyone else. And I ended up finding my own community and that was great. But going off to college actually was like huge for me because I opened up and I could finally be who I was, which was the extrovert.
That's it.
So I think there's something like really powerful, this idea. And maybe that this is part of just like the teenage years of getting to know ourselves and know how we interact with others in the world. But it's sort of like getting out of this notion of imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. And trying to live whatever we think, live our values and be authentic to what is most important to us. So you helped me understand that. Thank you, man.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And if you grow up the way that you just described, and that certainly characterizes a big phase of my life too, then I'm going to give a bold opinion here, and it may not be popular, but then you may grow up to be under the impression that removing that from your children's upbringing, let's say, is the wisest thing, but I'm just not sure that it is. Like, I don't like bullying, and I'm never going to put my child in a position to be bullied or to be a bully. But I do wonder whether we as a society are putting too much of an emphasis on these destructive tendencies that kids engage in. Because most of the people that I meet that are tough, bold, creative, have a truly unbreakable ethical core, have real values and principles they've developed over the years, is because they've had to go through a character building process of pain and struggle.
Adversity.
And I fear that we as a society are prizing comfort over character building. Again, I'm not pro-bullying. I'm just saying that in my desire to say reduce really nefarious bullying, I don't know that I would want to eliminate the opportunity for children to be destructive with one another, because I know that for me, there were many years of pain and fear associated with that phase, but that's in large part how I became who I am today and how I can appreciate where I've come. And if somebody said, would you do it differently or would you take any of those things away? I don't think I would. What do you think?
Yeah, so this is a million-dollar question, right? This is where I think there need to be constructive opportunities to face adversity. And there are plenty of those, right? So if bullying on the one hand, to your point, that's sort of like just open-ended, potentially chaos and can be destructive.
Yes.
The constructive ways to do that, number one, sports, right? Mm-hmm. And I've never been a fan of like the trophy culture, even though I've been guilty of that with my kids, right? Like in sports, you win or you lose. And that's a really good life lesson in a safe environment, presuming you've got, you know, really good coaches and intent on supporting and building, you know, skills and character with kids. But sports were huge for me growing up. I learned to win. I learned to lose a lot and to have to figure out, what do I do with the next step at?
Yeah.
What do I do with the next play in the field? Right.
Yeah.
So that's a constructive opportunity. Powerful for me were the outdoors. Like in, you know, between sixth and seventh grade, went to an outdoor camp for 2 weeks and learned climbing. Oh, you know, I almost pooped my pants the first time I got in a rope and had to get up like to the top of a cliff, or going down like class three rapids in a canoe with my, like, with my buddy who's also like 11 years old. Yeah. And we're like, are we going to get flipped? And are we going to be dead? And, you know, these are the days where you don't really have life jackets and stuff. Right. But again, like, these are not life threatening, but they are constructive opportunities to face adversity and build character.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like the next generation our kids deserve. Frankly, that's what each of us deserve. I don't care what stage of life you're in.
Yeah.
But that's what builds character. ABA practice owners, are billing and insurance issues getting you down? Well, let me tell you, Element RCM is your answer. Element provides world-class revenue cycle management services, contracting, credentialing, authorizations, billing, and more. Element's your partner, so you can focus on what you love to do, providing the highest quality services to your families and clients. Element's a preferred partner of the Behavioral Health Center of Excellence, and its founders have nearly 20 years of experience owning and operating successful ABA organizations. They understand you. They know that every dollar counts, that integrity is everything. Element works with any practice management system, and Element's not a vendor, they're your partner. So find out more and take a free revenue cycle assessment at elementrcm.ai. Let me ask.
I like that.
You have fallen in love, as I've gotten to know you, Rami, you've fallen in love with our autism field. How the heck did that happen?
So I started this company 6 years ago, and I took you through the story leading up to that. Mm-hmm. And just really quick, I looked at like 30 things. I knew that, first of all, I was unemployable. So I was not going to have a career as an employee. That was not going to happen. My chance at success was going to come from me figuring out a way to carve out a small sliver of the world that wanted to pay me for some very special service I could provide for them. And that was pretty much going to be my opportunity. So I looked at 30 things, found janitorial, and I thought, okay, almost no customers really love their janitorial company. Janitorial companies are turning over employees and customers like mad. And you're the lowest vendor on the totem pole for this reason, because this is how the stage has been set by the industry. So I thought, okay, well, anybody can get into this. So at least I can get into it. That much I know so far. So let me get in, and then maybe I can do something that's creative to stand out from the crowd.
Mm.
And got in. My first client was a string of indoor sports complexes, and I took over 500,000 square feet. And that was absolute murder. I was idle for like 6 months, just cursing myself. Why did you do this to yourself, you moron? You could have just been a lazy actor living in Los Angeles, walking down Hollywood Boulevard, and seven nights a week till 4 o'clock in the morning, you're cleaning toilets. You can't hold on to an employee because they don't respect you. You're not a leader. You can't attract anybody. You don't know what the hell is going on. Mm. It was just brutal, man, just brutal. And within about 6 months, I my back was against the wall. And I sometimes, when that's the case, you come out with your absolute best, guns blazing. And so I really fixed the problem. And I just developed a very, very simple set of philosophies that I was going to use moving forward. And they all revolved not around the customer, but around the employee. Mm. And I found how to attract the best and how to keep them.
Mm.
And customers naturally follow after that happens, obviously. But so, okay, I'm now 2 years into the business. So this is 4 years ago. And I know that I've got this unique gift. I figured out the attraction and retention problem that my cohorts cannot figure out. So where is that best going to be utilized? Where is it going to be the most valuable? And that was obviously the medical and health sector, for the obvious reason that if anybody needs cleaning to reflect their highest standards, it's the medical and health sector. Mm-hmm. And if anybody thinks about cleaning enough to have it as a real line item in their budget, it's the medical and health sector. You don't need to sell the medical and health sector on why they need cleaning. Mm. What you do need to sell them on is how your cleaning is going to be any different to the last 10 guys who promised them the world and delivered nothing. So the only promise I ever make, and I can keep it, is that, look, I attract the best people and I keep them. So that allows me to develop their skill set over the course of time. And you won't have any revolving door of new faces coming through your doors. And we'll work together. This will be a co-mission. We'll work together. And in the fullness of time, your needs will be met on a consistent basis. It'll take a little while to get there. That's not a promise that they're ever told. Mm. Right? They're told, hey, we're going to fix this quickly and it's going to be perfect. I'm like, it's not going to be perfect. It's going to start slow and we're going to slowly get it to where it needs to be. And then we're going to keep it there. And that worked really well for the medical and health sector. And that led me to my first ABA agency client. Mm. And this is a much better sampling of what I just described, in that your clients are children. So the mess is, it's truly inevitable that at the end of the day, you're going to have a whirlwind of chaos and you need it cleaned. Mm-hmm. And you've got, to the extent that your techs or your BCBAs are having to do the cleaning, this is going to exacerbate your turnover problem, which you have like any other field does. But certainly what you don't want is, you don't want to use the hyper-compassionate therapists that you've got in place to do serious work, having to then put on the janitor's hat at the end of the day. That's just not going to fly for very long, I don't think. Mm. And thirdly, you're an emerging field with seriously ferocious, capable entrepreneurial types coming in, and you're not all, but many are opening a clinic today with plans to have six clinics by tomorrow. So this is another way that I'm able to help, is that when you are in scale mode, you need your vendors to be doing top-notch work, because you can't stop scaling to worry about what's happening at the ground level. And so what I'm able to do is provide continuity across clinics and continuity across clinics across time, so that the ease and simplicity that you experience when you've got, say, two clinics with us is the same you'll experience when you have six. Mm-hmm. Because if it starts to get complicated for you at three or four, you're really screwed if you've got 10. Mm-hmm. Really screwed. So these are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about. And to me, these are the only problems worth solving. And to the extent that I'm solving them well, I'm doing my job. And I don't want to think about anything else that's fancy and peripheral. Mm-hmm. I want to focus on this stuff.
Which in turn allows BCBAs, RBTs, and ABA practices to provide the highest quality clinical services for their kiddos. Yeah. What I'm so struck by is that you, in getting into janitorial, you were almost less getting into janitorial than you were getting into what you wanted to be as a people business. And you've solved, very least, like, you've put retention front and center. Can you share like a couple of strategies? Because as you point out, this is a huge thing in our field, and it always will be. Turnover, that is. Tell me, like, what strategies you've used.
Sure. Some of them I still can't properly articulate, but I'll try. Okay. So the first one is that I think to myself, there's several filters that people go through between the time you post the job post and they show up for an interview.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to have as many people self-select out before they show up. Because I found early on that what was really tough for me was to interview 20 people and then try to remember who stood out or try to compare notes, because I'm taking notes after sitting down with two people. It's very different to my note taking after 11 people.
Mm.
Exhausted at that point. Or if it's on a different day, I'm feeling different that day. I got in a fight with my wife that day, so I'm different that day.
Yeah.
And so even my own notes, I felt, were not that reliable. And certainly my instinct wasn't reliable, because then I was just going to hire the people who are the most charismatic and charming.
Mm.
That doesn't mean that they're the most conscientious
mm-hmm.
or dependable or dutiful. So I try to craft my posts in such a way that it will intimidate most people and select them out.
Mm.
And I advertise a pay that is significantly more than my competitors are willing to pay.
Mm.
And the reason might be that I believe my one kick-ass employee will do the job of your two mediocre ones.
Mm.
So if you are paying your two mediocre employees $10 an hour, and I'm paying my one kick-ass employee $20 an hour, we're paying the exact same amount, and my headaches are half yours. Mm-hmm. The negative impact on my client is close to what it is for your client, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm willing to pay much more.
Mm.
By the way, if I'm truly attracting and retaining the best talent, I can also then go look for the best customers. And part of what makes a customer the best customer is that they can actually pay what the work is worth.
Mm.
So how's one of the ways that I offset paying people so well? I find the right paying customers.
Mm.
The cleaning is such an intricate part of their public image that they're willing to pay what it's actually worth.
Hmm.
Okay. So now I've got the best people showing up for the interview. Well, it's great to have the best five rather than 20 and try to figure out who the best five is. And at this point, I'm going to have a really, really casual interview like this. We're going to have a cup of coffee and I want to get to know the person. And my prayer is always that it's going to revolve around things like common interests. If we can talk about books, I love books.
Mm.
If we can talk about a love for coffee, great, I love coffee.
Mm.
So if we can get to common interests, it's going to tell me a lot about a person and how they fill their time.
Mm.
At this point, I've got a good sense of an individual, where they come from, and where I could take them if I can keep them, if they'll stay with me for years. How can I develop them? And I want to know what their professional goals are outside of, let's say, doing this, and if they have them, but what their personal goals are too, because to the extent that I can facilitate some of those personal goals or just enable some of those dreams to flourish, then we have a personal connection too, which is, you know, it's going to help in a long-term relationship.
Mm.
Okay, so this is kind of the stuff that I'm having a little bit of difficulty perfectly articulating, because it's just coming out of my mind and trying to wrap my head around it. There's one thing that's way more firm, and it's just straight ahead. Here's what it is: for every year that you stay with me, at the end of the year, I'll give you a bonus worth 10% of what you earned that year. So let's say that you earned $30,000 this year. At the end of the year, with your regular monthly check, you'll also get another check for $3,000.
Mm.
Okay? If you earn $30,000, an extra $3,000 is a real lifestyle change. It's a family vacation. It's putting it into your investment portfolio. It's, you know, remodeling the bathroom. It's a myriad of things for any of us. Any of us, when we have a 10% increase in income, it's very special.
Mm.
So this is another trust building exercise, because of course I onboard the person and I promise this bonus to them, and janitors have worked for other janitorial companies, and many times they've been treated miserably. They've been lied to. They've been promised things that never came to be. So I think what's happening for me is that I'll onboard somebody and I'll promise them this bonus. And basically, they're kind of buying into it, but in the back of their mind, they're thinking, yeah, right. Mm-hmm. At the end of the year, he's going to fire me, or I'm going to quit, and he's going to find some reason to not give me that money. And the most beautiful moment is when, at the end of the year, I say, hey, come over here for a cup of coffee and let's just shoot the shit and talk. And the check's just sitting on the table waiting. I mean, it spikes the trust like crazy. Mm-hmm. And so we've already built plenty of trust along the way, but now we're a year in and there's a new layer of trust that's just been opened up, a new dimension. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, it's been my experience that that, you know, the years after that are very solid years. Mm-hmm. So I'm excited to give that bonus at the end of each year to everybody who works with us.
That's powerful. You know what I hear you describing, and especially in the upfront interview process, and then as you build that trust, what you're doing is getting to know people and whom they are and what their passions are.
That's right.
What they want to do in life. And I mean, that's 90% of being in a human services, a people business.
That's right. That's right.
It's not necessarily just about, yes, interview questions are important or whatever. Like, there's a variety of, yes, important stuff you just got to do, but like demonstrating, taking the time to get to know your team and care about them.
Yeah.
Is a really powerful reflection.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, there's so much that I'd love to keep unpacking with you, Rami, but where can people find you online, man?
MidwesternJanitorial.com.
I don't.
And LinkedIn, of course.
You're on LinkedIn. You got a really neat following on LinkedIn. And I saw recently, congratulations, you're a committee, a committee chair for the Autism Alliance of Michigan.
Thank you very much. That's very cool.
I think that just, that reinforces your passion for our field. Yeah. So are you ready for hot take questions, sir?
Yeah, man.
All right. You're on your deathbed. What's the one thing you want to be remembered for?
Just time well spent with my kids.
What's your most important self-care practice?
Wine and cigars.
I love it. Favorite song?
Favorite song? Prison Sex by Tool.
Oh, heavy. Heavy. I thought you might go with like a Kickstarter.
I tried to go with something more appropriate.
Well, I was thinking back to just the Motley Crue days, Red Hot. Oh gosh, you talk about teenagers.
What was the name of the first Motley Crue album?
I think it was
Live Wire.
I think it was called Live Wire, and the title track, first song, Live Wire, and it just opens with Tommy Lee and Mick Martin just with this killer riff and just driving toward destruction.
There are some unbelievable songs, and that description is perfect on that
album. Oh, they were a live wire, right? Like you and I at our teenage, we were live wires. Careful, handle with care.
Yeah.
If you give your 18-year-old self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Keep headed down the crazy, wild, destructive path you're heading down, but know that eventually you're going to be super grateful for your parents and what they modeled for you, and don't take it to a point that you can't come back from, because you want them to be available when you want to show that gratitude.
Right on. All right. You can only wear one style of footwear. What is it?
Sandals with nothing else. No clothing, just naked and sandals. Yeah.
Just walk around. Any particular type of sandal? You think of Birkenstock, flip-flop?
Birkenstocks are great.
Again, 90s, very old school, but they're coming back.
Fantastic. They are.
Crazy.
Everything comes back.
Everything comes back. It's that generational thing. Rami, thank you so much for
being
on the pod. This is a ton
great,
of fun.
Great talking to you, Jonathan. Take care, my friend.
What up, listeners? Hey, I got something for you. If you like my Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast, you're going to love the Behavioral Observations podcast with Matt Sikoria. So I recently met Matt at ABAI, and let me tell you, I was just an instant fanboy. Matt's the real deal. His pod is all about stimulating talk for today's behavior analysts. So session 191 on his pod is on the behavior analysis of lying. That's right, lying. How awesome is that? Who does that? He also talks social skills, ACT, FAs, and so much more. His guests include Greg Hanley, Jonathan Tarbox, and other legendary names in our field. And as a BCBA, you could even get CEU credits through Behavioral Observations. You can find Matt and the Behavioral Observations podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast channel. Enjoy, friends.
Thanks for listening to Building Better Businesses in ABA podcast. Stay tuned for our next exciting episode. In the meantime, please like, subscribe, share, and comment. We value your feedback. Don't forget to follow us on social media at elementrcm.ai.